So I'm reading from the text called Reflections on the Art of Personality by Hedayata Nayak Khan. And these are beautiful little teachings. They're one or two sentences that can just be reflected upon. And so I'd like to share three of these, number 11, 12, and 13, because it, 11, 12, and 17, because they support this teaching that I'm about to share from Hazard and I come. Number 11. Every word that is said to one need not be taken so seriously that it upsets one, disturbs one's balance, and robs one of one's willpower to control one's reactions. There are things that matter, and there are things that do not matter. But one is often tempted to attach undue importance to unnecessary things. Or the King Rogers version is knowing when to hold it, knowing when to fold it. And knowing when to walk away, right? But sometimes we get in that pattern, you know. Everything is critically important, but it can be so exhausting to do that to oneself and energetically to others, you know, if they feel that. And they do. Number 12. Evaluating the importance or the non-importance of things, evaluating the importance or the non-importance of things said does not mean that one should be indifferent to what is said. It only means to have discrimination between that which is important and that which should not demand too much of one's attention. So it's not like numbing out either, but it's really kind of using mindfulness to determine things. Yes?
Would you please repeat number 11?
Yes,
Petra.
Sure. Every word that is said to one need not be taken so seriously that it upsets one, disturbs one's balance, and robs one of one's willpower to control one's actions. There are things that matter, and there are things that do not matter. But one is often tempted to attach undue importance to unnecessary things. It's funny too. I don't know why this story is coming to mind, but it does relate, but in a different way. You know, sometimes something is said, and have you ever completely interpreted it in the opposite way and gotten upset of what was intended, or you misunderstood something, or something was repeated in a way to you that didn't have the original impulse, and then it's very upsetting, and then only later you find out it wasn't that at all. Does that happen to anyone else in the room? Okay. So, story that illuminates this. Joe and I were doing a retreat at the Shambhala Mountain Retreat Center out in California, and that center is, it's overseen by a board of directors, but it's run by a lot of people that will come and live in residence and help to facilitate preparation of meals and cleanup and things like that, orientation to the retreat center, etc. And they had a new person that came on board that summer. And she was kind of a large woman. And there were bears, and there were all kinds of, you know, animals. God, what did they tell us? There was a cougar, some sort of a cat around, like, be careful, don't go out at night, because the mountain animals were active. So one night, a bear had literally come into the kitchen and gotten into the milk and the butter. And she overheard people saying, oh, some big bear went into the kitchen, got into the milk and butter. And she just took it that they were talking about her. And she was so mortally wounded and upset. And it was like, no, really, a bear came in. You know what I mean? So it's like sometimes we're also ready. You know, it's kind of like that's what this teaching is indicating. It's like, are we always ready for that fight? You know, it's kind of like, you know, how, you know what I'm saying. We have to be mindful of that. Are we just waiting for something to, you know, the trigger to go off, you know? So it's an interesting thing. But and maybe you don't have that, but some of us do. We could have that tendency. And just be mindful of it. It's a funny example, but it's true. And once then of course, you know, what happens afterwards is you feel utterly ridiculous that, you know, one responded so intensely when it was really not even, it was intended about the bear, not her. Right? And sometimes that happens to us. Oh my God, it really wasn't. It really isn't all about me, so to speak. So again, reading from the text of Reflections on the Art of Personality. Number 17. Everyone has faults. Each one of us, our friends and our enemies. If one wishes, therefore, for one's own faults not to be disclosed to others, it is obvious that one should spare others from one's own judgment. Isn't it Jesus that said, judge not lest we be judged? It's hard because you want to be able to all, I mean, you know, there is a balance there too, to have discriminating awareness, to be able to get out of harm's way, you know. Dalai Lama, he was asked one time, he was giving a teaching on emptiness. And this is a very... The idea being that everything is inherently empty because one can't distill that one singular thing that is inherent and born of its own self, that everything is independent upon everything else. And so some people get a little confused about this concept, but taken very deeply, we start to understand that this isn't really as it appears, and a chair isn't, a chair is really, we say that's a chair, but really it's wood and things that make it up, and somebody had to make it, and so, you know, there's a whole art of dialectics which asks one to question and discern in finer and finer ways to start to see that things are not as they appear, nor are they otherwise, as I said. Yes, it is a chair. But why is it a chair? It's a very complex thing. You get a glimpse of it now and again. So someone asked him, and I think this was in Dharamsala, about this this idea of emptiness. And he said, you know, the thing is in a way, if you're standing in the middle of the street and you say the truck is empty, that is true. On the other hand, it's true that it's a truck, and if you don't get out of the way, it's going to kill you. So it's like these two ideas, and those are called the two truths. The truths of emptiness and the truths of appearances. You know, you might want to have some commentary on that, our resident Buddhist, among others. Anyone else have anything to say? But it's good to train the mind and ask oneself, is this just the appearance of things, or what is the deeper source of it? Does that make sense? Are we all connected? Mm-hmm. I hope so. Yeah. It can be a little abstract, but I hope it's resonating somewhere. And it ties into this teaching on the art of personality, sort of beautifying the being to be more inclusive, more embracing, less judgmental, because ultimately if we're doing that to others, we are certainly doing it to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it's very hurtful to not accept ourselves. Are there any questions or comments from those here or those joining us?
That last segment, dropping the judgment.
Yeah.
It sounded so simple. Yeah, it sounds like the key to happiness.
Yeah.
And I've heard it said another way. Fred Luskin with the Stanford Forgiveness Project said, "The story stops with me."
Yeah.
So I appreciate hearing that.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that's true. And we can make those choices to drop those storylines. It's not easy. It's like if we do that, you know, the thing is that in some ways the universe doesn't like a void, and neither do we. If we drop something, are we okay being suspended in that state of complete openness? You know, it's kind of our nature. We like to feel, you know, maybe it's the desire to return to the womb, you know, whether physically or conceptually, but, you know, that comfort of having a container. But, you know, to stand sort of naked and open, it's not easy. But it's also wonderful and very freeing. And it's like, we say, well, if I'm not that, then what am I? I want to identify that, you know. Well, we're not our professions, and we're not just mothers, and we're not just, you know, husbands, or we're not just wives or husbands or, you know, whatever. We're not scientists or philosophers or teachers or whatever. We just are.
And brain science tells us that we're in those patterns because they're familiar.
That's exactly right.
And something else can become familiar.
Yep, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And I talk to my students about that in relationship to creativity. And you and I've talked a little bit about this too, sharing what we both know, that our brains are actually wired for survival. And in order to survive, you have to be able to do the same thing repetitively very well. Run when you see the big bear, you know, for example, plant and harvest. To do things repetitively is part of what our brain does. We've evolved scientifically, mathematically, you know, and spiritually in some regards, but our brain is still functioning in the way that it did, you know, when we began to stand upright and use the thumb. So you have to train new pathways, and anyone in the creative field, but I would say that spirituality is really the height of creativity. You have to retrain new neural pathways, and you do that by thinking in different ways. So again, these triggers that we find when we look into the limited self can be the very thing that calls us to prayer, that calls us to remember, that calls us to pray. Ah, here it is again. It's all God. Make sense? But a lot of times what happens is this, the resistance comes up, and the standard reaction is there. An unkind word, a withdrawal, you know, whatever. The pattern of thinking, of justification. But that's a pattern. And to look at repatterning is real important. And I think that's what these practices can do. Any comments? Or it's okay to disagree, too. That's fine. Or is it clear?
Just what popped into my mind, you know, speaking of Buddhism, but one of the techniques of training the mind about do something different, this just seems like what you're talking about right now, too. How we have to be so vigilant with our own mind to be able to make that decision to do something different, which isn't all that easy when we have all the repetition that comes up.
Yeah, because you can feel that line of thinking and it just keeps going the same way, but it's like again, the metaphor is not going to last too much longer. If we were a whole other generation sitting in the room, you may not understand it. You know, like pick the needle up off the vinyl and move it, you know, or get stuck, like on a record. You know, I guess DVDs do that too if they have a scratch. I'll have to change my metaphor. Or tape if it gets a kink. And that's what we do. It's torturous. We're so always seeking for happiness, and yet we're so involved in creating our own happiness or sustaining it. I know one summer I was going, I think I was very stressed because of my job. And when I get stressed, I can get the tendency to kind of get in a, it can go a little depressive, although it's not my nature and it's physically nor emotionally. But I saw, oh my God, I am just like so stressed. I really have to do, the Lojong teaching of do something different. One of the things that I love is to see beautiful things and sculptures and fountains and things. So I got in the car, and first I had to put my lipstick and earrings on. Just can't go anywhere without that. But, you know, I still had ratty old jeans and a ratty old top on. As long as I have lipstick and earrings, I'm good. That's my attachment. But at any rate, I got in the car and I went to Van Loo's. Does anyone go there? Do you know what it is? 75th and Prospect, is that? They have the most beautiful statues and fountains, and I just went there and spent so much time just, you know, and it was in the middle of the week, in the middle of the day, so there weren't many people there, so I could just get lost and listening to the fountains and looking at the pretty stuff. And it made me feel different. It changed it for me, you know. I was able to feel refreshed. So
there was a video that was done the artist's way. It's the artist's date. I mean, that's for, it's a spiritual kind of path for creativity.
Yeah.
Yeah, those artist days where you go and just, you sort of just kind of nourish yourself.
Right.
Listen to music or a concert or something.
Yeah.
It's just something you do with yourself.
Yeah, and music can really do that too. Thank you.
Well,
it's a higher language.
I think spiritualism, creativity is the key. To make yourself happy.
Yeah.
You really, and then you can just pick up and start tearing into stuff and creating something and doing something and, you know, just completely forget. But when you don't have any creativity, you better get it or you're going to be stuck.
Okay, words of mama.
You can see it.
No, it's true. It's true. And creativity creates new pathways.
If you don't have any creativity, you can't get out of it. You're going to be still with the same thing. And I'm 80 years old, and I can see it in people over and over and over again. Nothing different. No creativity. No excitement about pulling the flowers apart and fixing a big vase of flowers or tearing something out like I did the other day. And it's just like, okay, don't call me. I don't want to hear about this stuff. I mean, this is it. And take it from me, it's the truth. I don't lie. I tell it how it is, and if nobody likes it, well, you know. But that's it. It's the truth. It is.
And different people have different things that they like to do. Gardening or baking or cooking. Or those are creative things as well. So again, on the teachings of the development of personality, the teaching is, what is the ego? Know thyself, and thou wilt know God, said the great Sufi philosopher Ali. To know the self is the most difficult thing in the world, because what man can perceive first is a part only of the self, a limited part. When man asks himself, what is it in me that is I, capital I, he finds this body and his mind, and in both he finds himself limited and apart from others. And it is this conception of his being that makes man realize himself as an individual. If man dived deep enough within himself, he would reach a point of his ego where it lives an unlimited life. It is that realization that brings man to the real understanding of life. And as long as he has not realized his unlimited self, he lives a life of limitation, a life of illusion. When man in his illusion says I, in reality it is a false claim. Therefore, everyone has a false claim of I, except some who have arrived at a real understanding of the truth. This false claim is called in Sufic terms nafs. Nafs is, it could be interpreted as ego. And the annihilation of this false self is the aim of the sage. So let me go back for a moment. When man in this illusion says I, in reality it is a false claim. Therefore, everyone has a false claim of I, except some who have arrived at a real understanding of the truth. This false claim is called in Sufic terms nafs, or ego, and the annihilation of this false self is the aim of the sage. But no doubt to annihilate the false self is more difficult than anything else in the world. And it is this path of annihilation that is the path of the saints and the sages. One may ask, why should one take the trouble to annihilate the ego? Since life is full of pain and suffering, why add to the suffering? The answer is that even if an operation will cause one suffering, it is better to endure it in order to be cured. Now here I think it's a little bit of Nayak Khan's humor coming out. You know, it's like, well, why bother? You know, why take on more than we are? You know, it's like, Mayakopa, there's enough suffering, why should I be bothered? But I think that's a good answer. The answer is that even if an operation will cause one suffering, it's better to endure it in order to be cured. The same can be said of medicine that doesn't taste so good. The inborn nature of the ego is intolerance. That is its nature, because there are other egos that jar it. But again, I think initially, you know, we had this, it's a sense of survival. The inborn nature of the ego is intolerance. That is the nature, because there are other egos that jar it. It is therefore that when two cocks meet, they want to fight. The reason is that the ego of one jars upon the other. Even in the silent life, such as that of a rock, can jar upon another ego. For instance, that of a bull, who wants to hurl himself upon it and break it with his horns. I don't know if you've seen that, you know, like the rams or the mountain sheep, they do that all the time. Butt their heads against those rocks. It is the nature of the ego to exist alone. It is the nature of the ego to exist alone. It cannot allow another to exist. No doubt the reason is still deeper. It belongs to the deep side of metaphysics, but the moral aspect can't. can be understood. It is the nature of the ego to exist alone. It's like, if we think about it, towards the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the one, and then here Murshid is teaching that it is our nature to want to exist alone. It's like we are in our small way trying to make ourselves this Godhead of sorts. It's really quite absurd when you think about it. But we do that. Each one of us do, surely, in some way. Is there a question here?
Well, Alima had asked about, Alima Petra had asked about jar. And so, but I think she just wanted to make sure she understood that that was the word you were saying.
Yeah, but it's to be understood as a kind of friction or a butting against each other. Is that clear?
Yes.
The finer an ego becomes, the less it jars upon another. The finer an ego becomes, the less it jars upon another. In the different degrees of evolution of man, one sees this gradual development of the ego. There are people who seem to have no thorns, and yet they have a thorn which makes itself felt in the presence of another. It is their ego. So maybe this person is just, you know, for example, to put it in our common vernacular, has, you know, it for the most of the time is very functional and harmonious in the world. But there's one particular person that they just, you know, just really gets to them. And sometimes it's interesting if you look to the deeper side of that, and I think Murshid's indicating that, it's a reflection. Something's being reflected back to us that perhaps is even hidden from our ordinary view about ourselves. And that person may be showing something to us. It's a very interesting psychological point, but it's often true.
Isn't that called projection?
It could be called projection. Certainly in Jungian psychology, they would call it a kind of mirror projection. That we put it outside so that we can see it back at ourselves. At the same time, it may be something that's within the shadow or the unconscious dimension that this individual's making much more conscious for us. So in that way, maybe it's a reflection and not so much a projection. Could be both. What did you say?
You spot it, you got it.
If you
actually see it, because you're seeing this, that's also something you need.
Yeah. And it may be something where, you know, we just sort of say to ourselves, well, how dare they? You know, but it's kind of like, well, we wish we could dare to do that, to be that bold, to have that forthrightness, or, you know, there it may be that, too. You know, or, well, they're just so smug all the time. Well, you know, is there something about us that's that way, too? Very self-righteous. It's interesting. We can see that.
There's also other attributes they have what's that part? When it's about the ego, it jars on others.
Sure.
Well, it could be, you know, okay, I think I'm smart. Well, you know, I can see that, but I can't see people being rude. And when rudeness comes out, I don't think that's a projection of me on persons that are rude.
However,
duty. You want others to do unto you.
Sometimes one's duty is to also stop an action that's harmful to another.
Mm-hmm.
So, I say this to my students at the college. It's like, if you see someone doing wrong, take the responsibility to help them do right. quietly bring it to their attention, or you see someone slacking off, you must remember that we are only as great as our lowest common denominator. And if someone isn't meeting the expectations that can raise the group, you know, then kind of say, what's going on here? Do you need to take us some, you know, I usually say it myself, but making them responsible for their community is also very good. And so when someone's being rude, maybe the thing is to say, this kind of speech is harmful, and I don't think it's a good path to go down at this time when we can be more civil. Let's talk again. You know, I think that it's okay to have that line and to reflect that back to someone. But with respect, it doesn't need to necessarily come from anger, which can also show one another way. I don't need to tell you these things, you know them. But it's good for us to all remember them. The finer an ego becomes, the less it jars upon others. In the different degrees of evolution of man, one sees this gradual development of the ego. There are people who seem to have no thorns, and yet they have a thorn which makes itself felt in the presence of another. It is their ego. Others are like the roses, with its softness, beauty, and fragrance. No doubt, not everyone is a rose, but everyone desires the rose and not the thorn. The best training is to try to turn this thorny ego into a rose. It is very hard. The finer and the more evolved the ego, the harder life becomes for one. The higher and more refined you are, the greater trials you will have to go through in life. The more sensitive you become, the more you will have to suffer. Well, this doesn't feel like good news, does it? Well, let's go on. It's always darkest before the dawn, they say. The thorn cannot hurt another thorn, but the slightest thing can hurt a rose. It is not surprising if an ego that has become a flower does not wish to live among thorns, but that is its destiny. And in spite of all suffering, it is preferable to be a rose rather than a thorn. I don't think we have to go very far. I mean, we can look at the life of Jesus Christ, for example, and what he endured. Or even the Buddha, you know. I mean, we don't have any great stories about people trying to persecute him or kill him, but he had people close to him that were jealous and did wish him harm, tried to poison him. And you see that a lot. I mean, a teacher whose heart is completely open and flowing with love can be so easily wounded by harshness. But all of us can be that way. When we're completely open, we know that we can feel something so deeply, and that's why sometimes we close that part of ourselves and we become predictable in terms of our daily life and our interactions. It's kind of that repatterning that we need to do. But it's a choice. You know, do we want to be that way? Do we want to be like monoliths walking around and bumping into each other? In some ways, being open is the difference perhaps between a wooden door and a screen door. A wooden door is just can be knocked on, but a screen door, it's possible things can maybe move in and out of it easier too. You can put a nail in, it'll stick in a wooden door, but it won't in a screen door.
Sorry. Semi-permeable membranes.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. The best training is to try to turn this thorny ego into a rose. It is very hard. And the finer and the more involved the ego, the harder life becomes for man. Does anyone remember the quote by an icon about the tender heart, the rock of character? It's something like that. You know, like having this very tender heart, but then having a rock of character so it gives you stability. I don't have the exact, it's probably on a post-it out there actually on my computer. I love that quote. There's also a very beautiful quote there about the difficulties of life that could be read if you find it. You'll have to open my post-its. The thorn cannot hurt another thorn, but the slightest thing can hurt a rose. It is not surprising if an ego that has become a flower does not wish to live among thorns, but it is its destiny. And in spite of all sufferings, it is preferable to be a rose than a thorn. Preferable. Preferable.
Your
tomato, tomato.
Your grandmother said to you that you looking at this. I think I must have learned that before. Correct. Preferable.
To turn to the question why one ego jars another, the answer is that one must understand the nature of the other egos. To return to the question why one ego jars another, the answer is that one must understand the nature of other egos. When one dog barks at another, the other wags his tail. It is to let the other understand him and not fight with him. It is this moral that Christ taught from beginning to end. If you wish to experience fully the beauty of life, you must make your ego as fine as possible. This allows the grosser egos to come into contact. It is from that that good and evil have come. It is always from the grosser ego that one can call evil comes, and it is from the finer that comes which we call good.
Read that part again.
If you wish to experience fully the beauty of life, you must make your ego as fine as possible. This allows the grosser egos to come in contact. It's a little bit of an awkward phraseology, but I'll give a little commentary. It is from that that good and evil have come. It is always from the grosser ego that what we call evil comes, and it is from the finer that which comes which we call good.
You know, talking about the ego, I think that you have to be true to yourself. And truth, it reminds me of what the diet left me with that quote. You know, I don't think you have to fight so hard if your ego is, you know, you're true to yourself and you're like truth is truth is its own position. No, what is it now? Truth. See what happens?
Diet. And that's thinking, you know, if you're true to yourself and you're truth, you know, you're really true, your ego doesn't have to.
Pierre Mershatadayat said to Mom, and we were having a private conversation during one of his visits, and he said, truth doesn't need to fight for its own justification, yet falsehood...
Untruth has to always fight for its own position. Mm-hmm. Truth doesn't have to be a... I have it in my mind.
Karuna Mai, a good friend of ours that lives in India, and she's one of the trustees of the teachings of Sri Aurobindo and a great student of Hazar Nai Khan, loves to tell this story about truth and falsehood, and so this comes from the motherland of India. She said, we have a saying that this world, the contemporary world especially, becomes very confused by what is truth and what is falsehood. And she says, we have a story that truth and falsehood went to the river to bathe together. And they sort of disrobed and they were naked as they entered the river. And falsehood hurried up and got finished earlier in its bathing and ran to the riverbank and put on the cloak of truth. Mm-hmm. Now everywhere falsehood goes, everyone thinks it's the truth. Is a really important thing to think about. What we value or believe to be true, and certainly in this time of newspapers and internet, you know, we tend to read things and we think they're true. You know, there's a beautiful story that I think appeared recently, and I didn't see that, but I'll ask a friend of mine about the misunderstanding of the women that veil themselves. You know, we think that this is a whole sort of persecution and limitation of women. I tell you, I met many of them in Morocco, women that have chosen to re-veil after they were unveiled. Morocco was a very contemporary, they were very French. They almost identify with the French more than their own continent of Africa. But they have a long history of being Muslims. And we certainly can't imagine what it might feel like, although we may know that in the future, but to know what it could feel like for another culture to come in and assume us. And then all of a sudden we're speaking another language, and our beautiful architecture and things that are meaningful to us, our history, is eradicated and it's replaced. And then to have go through that kind of true oppression in the name of truth. We're going to give you a contemporary society, we're going to show you the way, we're going to bring you into the 20s or whatever, 19th, 20th, 21st century, blah, blah, blah. You know, these are all the stories that are told in order for one country to do this to another country, and we see this time and time again. What is that? Someone's telephone.
Oh, it's on the library, sorry.
It was a sign.
It is a sign.
I thought I was beeping.
You were looking at it like when Leo makes a little boomer at his buddy. He looks at it like, that, what is that? Where did that come from? Capria thought she was booming. But what has happened is when those cultures are allowed to reclaim themselves, and especially I can say in Morocco, I think also other countries I'm seeing this, but women are re-veiling in a way to sort of reclaim their identity as, you know, an Islamic woman or a Moroccan woman, and we see this in other cultures, and I would not call that fundamentalism. I would call that a reclamation of identity. And so I know some very young women that have gone to university and they're professionals, and they were completely unveiled, and they've chosen to reveil for that purpose. So it's not, if we, here's the judgment. We judge it from afar because we make assumptions about how we would feel, but we're not within that context. And it's not so easy to judge. We must be careful about that. And this is what creates differences, and this is what creates fights, and this is what ultimately creates wars. And going to battle is exhausting in whatever realm you choose to battle. You know how you feel after a fight?
Mm-hmm.
You just feel awful. And you think, my God, all that energy, if I put it into cleaning the house or whatever, I'd be done by now and I'd feel happy because, well, I'd have something to show for it. But it's just exhausting. It's not something that is productive or a good use of energy. And but this happens again and again in bigger or smaller ways, internally, externally, people to people, communities to communities, countries to countries, religion to religion. And that's the false claim. That's the false claim of the I, instead of we. Hosra Nat Khan, when he came to America, at that time people were still going through Ellis Island, and they were questioned, you know, what is your name, what is your nationality, what is your religion? And when they asked him, what is your nationality, what is your race, first of all, and he said, the human race. And he wasn't being a smart aleck. He really felt that way, that he was part of the human race. And, you know, what is your religion? The religion of all. You know, what are your beliefs? All beliefs, I include. Any comments?
That is, truth doesn't have to be defended, but untruth has to fight for its own position,
its own justification.
Mm-hmm. When I was driving here, my sister called me, and I don't know if it's fifth, but it's, she mentioned something to me, and it seems to fit in this context. There's no point to make a point.
Yeah, there's no point to make a point.
It just doesn't go anywhere. It's
Well, and often it becomes the line that gets drawn that creates the fight. You know what I mean? It's like drawing the sword. It's like, okay, I'm ready for battle.
Yeah, if somebody says something about you and it's a really out lie and you know it is, and, you know, it's like, okay, well, somebody says to you, are you going to go say something to them? Because that can really ruin your reputation. You know, well, my thing is, no. Because if they were going to make such a lie up about you, and you, what's the point? Point of trying to make a point by saying something to them? So it's not, I mean, they can lie and say, well, I didn't do that. I didn't say it. So what's the point to make a point? That's right. Mm-hmm. Just let it go.
Don't feed it.
Mm-hmm.
Nat Khan talks about us being that, you know, he, in some of the other teachings that we've studied, he gives the analogy that, excuse me, we are like keys on a piano. And that he says, well, it's not the fault of one key or the other if they don't harmonize. You know, think about that. But he does say that the role of one on the path is to be the keynote through which all other notes are tuned. And so when he's saying here, you had asked if I could read that again, that part about this allows the grosser egos to come in contact, you know, with the finer egos. It's if we start to think of things in a very subtle way. I mean, the teaching is rather concrete, but from another point of view, it can be very subtle. If we think about the subtlety of a fine. I mean, surely we've all been in the presence of someone that just by their mere presence, we feel all questions are answered, or we feel immediately calm or comforted. I hope you've had the benefit of that. I can't say. I've been blessed with that myself, which shows me that there is nothing that person particularly did or said, but it's their atmosphere. That they radiate a certain kind of vibration that can affect my vibration or other people's vibrations. And that's what Murshid is, or Hazrat Naikana is encouraging us to do, that we have to take ourselves by the reins and do this work, because it alters the vibration in such a way, it's like tuning the instrument to, you know, a higher vibration, so that that can then influence others. And it does, it has its influence. And the whole body of teachings that we've completed over the last several years on the breath, it talks about that. That the current of the breath of someone that's tuned to the proper pitch can be so strong, it can change the atmosphere in others. And we were doing that even on the plane. Remember, we had another example of a baby that was, I think, sometimes on the descents or the air pressure changes that just on those small little ears, you know, and people are just getting roar. I told you, let's breathe and see if we can. And the mother, you could feel she was getting so upset too, because she couldn't calm the baby, and so it was all about all this excitement starting to happen. And so we kind of worked on the breath, and then I just knew, you know, that that had to be broken. And luckily we were just in front of them. And I thought, so I took my prayer beads out and the light was shining. And just the whole way down, I was like... And they were from Jordan, I think. The woman, she was actually veiled in the chip. A beautiful little girl with her that looked like a China doll, and this beautiful baby. But I just kept saying, oh, the poor baby. Because the people I knew around were getting so upset with the crying. But it was like, to think of the poor baby, how it must have been suffering. And everyone started to change and laugh and kind of connect a little bit. It was very sweet. And I told the mother, you need some of these. Go get some. Because it was like... I just was the whole time just like... I didn't dare stop till we completely landed and were ready to deplane. But it was interesting how changing the attention from one sense to the other, you know, just made it focus... And forgot itself in a way, which is interesting. When we focus on the divine or something that inspires us, we forget ourselves. We forget that I. And we become something more. The boundaries get a little looser.